The Guardian.
The Guardian is delighted to announce the launch of our new Global Development Professionals Network. It's completely free, and it's the place for global development professionals to share, discuss, and promote new ideas about the sector. With weekly newsletters, a first look at jobs, and live Q&As with global development experts. As a listener to this podcast, we're offering you the chance to win an iPad just for signing up to the network today. To find out more, head to guardian.co.uk/win the iPad.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
I changed a sentence about Linus Pauling. He didn't like the sentence, so...
He saw it.
He saw it and strongly didn't like it.
The Nobel laureate James D. Watson, co-discoverer of the structure of DNA and author of one of the most iconic science books of all time, The Double Helix. Watson visited the Guardian studios this week, and my colleague Robin McKee will be along to tell me about his meeting with the legend of modern science. And
we feel that there is a need for something that is different than nature and science, one of which is that it will be available free of charge to anybody. Indeed, it'll be free of charge to authors as well.
We've talked about open access a lot on this pod, but now with the launch of eLife, open access to scientific research has moved up a level. I speak to the editor-in-chief, Randy Sheckman. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian.
The most important thing is that it is reliable, that it gives back the credibility that young people in particular question with Jones at the moment.
We really need to get our scientists to use their resources most efficiently. That includes not doing a lot of experiments just to satisfy some editorial policy, but rather allowing the authors, in this case the scientists, to decide what is the most important experiments.
The Wellcome Trust feels very strongly that research isn't complete until it's published. And it's vital that with all of the funding that goes into funding medical research, that the value of that is maximised. That can only be achieved if it's made available to the entire world in open access form.
That was a clip from the promotional trailer to the launch of a new scientific journal. You don't get many of those, but this is no ordinary journal. It has the heavyweight backing from some of the world's biggest funders of research. In the trailer you just heard, in order were Professor Herbert Jackall, Vice President of the Max Planck Society in Germany, Dr. Robert Chian, President of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute in the US, and Sir Mark Wolpert, Director of the Wellcome Trust in the UK. All of them hope that the new open access journal called eLife will bring about a sea change in how scientific papers are published and distributed. Broadly, this is a move to bring about more open access to research. To find out more, I spoke to the editor-in-chief of eLife, Randy Sheckman, himself a professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California, Berkeley.
eLife is an open access online journal that seeks to represent all of the life sciences, all the way from psychology to biophysics, and to do so with some great selectivity. We wish to publish really only the finest contributions in all of life sciences, which means that we'll be really competing with journals such as Nature and Science Magazine that appeal very broadly to the entire scientific community. However, we feel that there is a need for something at that level of selectivity, that is different than Nature and Science, different in many ways, one of which is that it's open access, that it will be available free of charge to anybody. Indeed, it'll be free of charge to authors as well. We have very significant backing from some important foundations, the Wellcome Trust, the Max Planck Society, Howard Hughes Medical Institute, who all feel very strongly that they should have a direct role in ensuring that their investigators, and indeed all investigators, have an opportunity to display their best work in an open access forum, which has really not been generally available. Only 10% of the scientific literature in the life sciences is in a truly open access format.
Now, this move towards open access is something that is increasingly popular now in terms of the research funders like the Wellcome Trust, Research Councils UK here in the United Kingdom, insisting that the research that they fund be published in these sorts of journals. So if you are taking money from them, you must make the results available for free to everybody who wants to see them.
Yes.
And I suppose the question is, you know, how you do that. So lots of models, as you say, imply that you pay a certain amount to get your work published. And that's happening. And there are organizations out there like the Public Library of Science, and you can pay in for Nature or Science to be open access. What do you think specifically that your journal, eLife, is going to do to really push that faster?
Yeah. Well, there are two things. One is, I've already said, what we feel very strongly is that there aren't enough journals at the very high end, very selective, identifying the most important contributions, but important as judged by, in our case, as judged by active scientists who comprise the members of the membership of our editorial board. So this is something we feel very strongly about. That's a little different than what other high-end journals do. We have selected active scientists to make all the final decisions.
Given the fact that you're free to publish in, and you'll be highly selective, so it'll be prestigious to publish in the journal, is there an intent somewhere that perhaps it would force the other big journals like Nature or Science or Cell to either go this way or reduce their paid charges or reduce the amount they charge people?
Yes, they are feeling the pressure for open access. I know for a fact, having discussed this with the editor-in-chief of Nature, that he sees this as the future of his journals, and they will move in that direction. They've already started in small ways. They have a few titles that are open access, and Cell likewise, and Science Magazine will definitely go in this direction as well. They have to figure out how to do this consistent with their requirement to raise revenue for their commercial concern, or in the case of Science Magazine, which is run by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, to generate revenue for the good deeds that they do for the scientific community. We are under no such pressure. We don't have to generate a profit. We don't even have to break even. So we're in a really kind of a privileged position for quite some time to build the journal up to be at the high level that we aspire to.
So just explain to me a bit about what this journal is going to look like and how it will work. Will it be recognizable to every scientist as a normal scientific journal with papers and review articles and editorials, that kind of thing?
Absolutely.
Or do you have anything different particularly?
Well, we intend to build into the journal. We have plans afoot, and we'll be rolling out quite interesting electronic features that are not typical in journals even that have an online presence. Instead of relying on this impact factor that I dismiss as an accurate measurement of quality, we will have what are referred to as article-level metrics. So an author publishing a paper in eLife will be able to follow in virtually real time as his or her article is accessed, either by readers clicking on the link or downloading articles or eventually citing their papers or any press coverage that an article generates. All that information will be online for the author and for anybody to see for each article. We feel very strongly that the importance of an article should be measured by the number of downloads and citations that article achieves rather than relying on some aggregate number that applies to the whole journal. If you look at the number of citations for articles in a journal, very important journal like Nature, there's an enormous range of citations among the articles in an issue. Some generate thousands of citations, others generate virtually no citations. So it's more important to follow an individual article's impact than to follow the aggregate impact of all the articles in a journal over a period of time.
And so we
will have that available. We will also have enormous flexibility in the electronic format to offer authors the opportunity to have movies directly on the screen, to have three-dimensional images that can be manipulated by a reader. There's something called the three-dimensional PDF that allows a reader to click on an image and then rotate. You know, you can look at a galaxy, you can look at a protein molecule and twist it and turn it about right on the screen. These are things that you simply can't do in the print version. And one of the reasons why the electronic medium is so much more powerful than the traditional print version.
So tell me the kinds of papers you're looking for.
Well, we're looking for papers that make substantial contributions in all areas of life science. We're not going to focus on only those areas that are considered fashionable. I think a lot of the commercial journals are driven by this reliance on impact factor to make their selections based on areas that will simply generate a lot of attention, a lot of citations. I think most scientists would much prefer to have their work judged by their peers based on quality evaluations rather than some perceived larger influence. So we're looking for papers that make substantial new discoveries that are not merely incremental, that move an individual discipline within the life sciences forward in a clearly measurable way.
Many thanks there to Professor Randy Scheckman. To explore this new kind of science periodical, go to their website, elifesciences.org. Now for some open access to The Guardian and Observer's science journalists. To take a look at some of this week's science news, I'm joined by The Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, and by The Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample. Welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello.
Ian, let's talk about the autumn statement. George Osborne made some budget announcements. The autumn statement's becoming more and more important these days. It's usually that it was once a year we'd have some statement about the budget, but now the autumn statement, it seems to be the place where decisions are made. So tell us what was in there for science.
Well, the top line for science was that there are going to be cuts across Whitehall departments, but those, and this is sort of savings across all departments in Whitehall, but that money, they're going to use $600 million to put into science. So the science research budget isn't going to be affected by those cuts across the departments. And the $600 million that they do get, some $600 million of the money they do get will go into facilities. So for UK-British science facilities.
So let's just make this clear. In 2010, during the comprehensive spending review, the first one the government did, science budget was frozen. But as science campaigners and other scientists pointed out, the facilities budgets were slashed in half and causing all sorts of problems. You can't obviously do research without those facilities or upgrading those facilities. So is this $600 million some way of recognising those issues, or is it something completely new where they're going to build brand new labs and things?
So just to talk to what you were just mentioning there, I mean, yes, you're right in that we can't ignore the fact that in 2010 the government cut the science facilities budget, the so-called capital spending budget, by half, and it was about $1.5 billion that they cut in half, and it left the $4.6 billion science research budget, so for grants for students and things like that, intact, and that's been ring-fenced. Now, what they've done with they've steadily been adding back to this facilities, this capital spending budget over the since 2010. So after chopping it, they've since been topping that up, and this $600 million goes into very consciously identified areas where they see that Britain can get an edge and make money. Bench, basically. This is about using science and technology to try and reinvigorate
the economy.
What
are some of those areas?
So some of the areas they've highlighted are things like energy storage, advanced materials, so things like graphene, which won the Nobel Prize fairly recently. Big data is something that the government's very keen on. There's sort of big awareness that more and more science and more work is involving enormous data sets, and there's money to be had from being able to handle and process those. Other areas, energy-efficient computing, and they're still very excited about synthetic biology.
Robin, a few weeks ago, George Osborne, the Chancellor, made quite a high-profile speech about his appreciation for science, saying that not only is it there for economic benefit, but also it's there for intellectual progress and so on. It's at the Royal Society. And this is him putting some money into that, behind those words. He mentioned synthetic biology and advanced materials and all sorts of things. $600 million for facilities in those areas. Is this a recognition that the government is, you know, getting back on board with science?
Yes, I think it is, actually. It strikes me as an aged hack of
too many years that every time a government comes in, it looks around and goes, oh, how can we save money? It tends to be suspicious about science.
What are you doing with all that stuff?
What do you need that big facility for? Why are we paying all this money to the European Space Agency? Why are we paying this money to hunt for little particles below the Swiss mountains? And they slash back, and then slowly the penny drops. They're kind of bombarded, perhaps. They're got at by the Royal Society, and the penny drops that, in fact, you know, it's actually money quite well spent, and Britain is extraordinarily good at science, and a great deal of our money comes from it.
And it's good that they've realised it, but why do they scientists have to make this case every 2 years?
Probably every four years or so.
You'd think they'd remember, right?
The whole point of it being a new government is you think you're going to be a new broom and you're going to sweep everything away and not make the mistakes of the previous incarnation. But why do we have to be persuaded every 4 years? It's a very good question. I wish I knew the answer.
Also, I think what's changed in the last three or four years is that the scientific establishment themselves and campaigners are much more organised about making this case more readily through social media and blogs and all sorts of other places, events, where maybe a decade ago they weren't so good at this sort of thing?
I would agree. There's one other thing, by the way. I said we've got here John Osborne saying, science is great. But science is great when it suits him, but it's not so great when it doesn't suit him. And he's utterly ignored the science about carbon emissions and his dash for gas. Completely ignores what science is saying, which is stop carbon emissions.
Just explain that a little bit. So this was something else in the autumn statement where there's going to be lots of encouragement for companies to build gas-powered power stations.
And cut back, from our commitment to building up renewable energy sources, which also has great potential to be a money earner for this country. But he has to listen to his Tory backbenchers who don't like wind farms and don't believe in climate change, which of course shows how demented they are.
I think there's something going on here when you ask about why is it that scientists always have to make their case for science. I think, well, you have to think about it. You can't look at science as just this enormous sort of monolith. I mean, a lot of science that gets attention is very basic science. A lot of the science we write about day in, day out is basic research. And this is the government funding science that they have chosen to make money through the research councils and such like that. I mean, this is absolutely about making money, and it's really sort of, you know, getting technologies up and running. That's why so much money is going into the UK space industry, because pretty much outperforming any other British sector. You know, it's growing at the sort of rate that China's growing at. You know, I think you can confuse things and saying this is the government getting behind science. It's getting behind certain sciences that it sees as making money and serving a purpose.
But on the other side of that, of course, is that the science campaign groups have been making this case. If you invest in us, we will help you get out of the recession. And it doesn't seem strange, therefore, the government would sort of pick that argument up.
There's a danger in this, though, if you go too far. If you look at the last government, and when George Gordon Brown was when he was Chancellor, and all these scientists, when they had the grant applications, it also said as part of the grant application, how will your project make money for Britain? Well, I mean, that's not the nature of the science they're doing. So you can go far too far down this road and point to say that this is going to make money, therefore we will invest in it. That's not the nature of science.
Okay, well, let's move on to something. Well, let's move on to space. And you mentioned that the British space industry is doing incredibly well. The American ones are doing not too badly, too. Over on Mars, Curiosity found something. We discussed this a bit last week. What did it actually find?
Well, this was one of the most anticipated press conferences probably of the year. And it came about because of some sort of off-the-cuff comments by John Grotzinger, one of the project scientists on the Mars Curiosity program, where he said that the results that were coming out of Mars Curiosity were going to be earth-shaking. And so various media sort of leaped to the conclusion that this would be evidence for life on Mars and so on. And the more sober ones said, well, maybe they found organics. And, you know, the significance of organics is that if you have certain organics on a planet, they may be useful in supporting life. You can't really have life without them. It doesn't seem, not life as we know it. Although there's ambiguity here. You can find organics that can be produced naturally under fairly sort of boring geochemical conditions, or they can just rain down from meteorites. So what did they find? Well, The announcement was no definitive discovery of organics, and you know the subtleties in the language here. I mean, what they did is they found signs of some small organics being these molecules that have chains of carbon atoms in them, and they can't say. First of all, the first question is, where do those organics come from? They don't know. It's too early. It may be that they are something very exciting to do with life. That's one of many possibilities. It's also entirely probable or entirely possible that this is carbon that was carried up by the rover, just kind of contamination that forms an organic compound when you heat it up with other stuff. And it may well be just organics that's come down on meteorites, because I mean, meteorites are raining down on Mars like they are on Earth all the time. So they found some kinds of organics, some small ones. They don't know where they come from, and they certainly don't know what their relevance to life is yet.
Is there any way of working out the answer to that question, where they come from?
Yeah. What you need to do is get far more of them, first of all, do more sampling, get more of these compounds, nail down exactly what compounds you have, and then you can start doing more detailed analyses on those compounds to work out, do they match the kinds of organics that we see coming down in meteorites or that we know would come down in Martian meteorites, or are they something that is just likely to have been produced in some atmospheric reaction in Mars? And then you narrow it down, and then you can come up with a probability that it could be more from one process than another.
Now, no doubt Curiosity is going to keep finding wonderful things out over the next few years. But NASA this week also talked about its future plans for space exploration, and yet another rover that's going to be sent to Mars by 2020. It's going to be a copy of the Curiosity rover, essentially the same thing, but with different scientific experiments on it. Robin, good idea to go back to Mars so quickly?
Well, I wouldn't say it was quickly. That's 8 years. And given that they had two other missions in between scheduled and scrapped them because of cuts to NASA's budget, this is actually kind of belatedly going back to Mars. I mean, America was supposed to be joining Europe in the ExoMars project, pulled out. And that project still hangs. Well, it doesn't hang in the balance, but it's in a precarious state. The Russians have stepped in to go with Europe, but given that every single Russian probe to Mars has ended up either missing the planet or failing a launch, it's not a happy kind of prospect. So, 8 years' time before we go back, that's a long gap. At one point, America was talking of going every 2 years. So they find something exciting. We're going to have a long and rather frustrating wait, I would say.
So ExoMars is scheduled for 2018, is that right?
2017-18.
That's got the equipment that can perhaps look for actual signs of life properly, unlike Curiosity, which doesn't have that sort of experiment. I mean, but we don't know if ExoMars will happen.
At the ESA's council meeting last month, they were insisting it was going to happen. But I personally have got my doubts. I mean, the Russians have got a terrible record in going to Mars.
OK, well, that's it for this week's news. If you want to read about any of that stuff, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science.
If you could just introduce yourself first of all, Jim.
Yeah, I'm Jim Watson,
You don't have to say me.
Yeah. Now, Robin, you met someone very interesting this week. Tell us who we've just heard.
I met James Dewey Watson, who, of course, is one of the co-discoverers of the structure.
Is that who he is?
Yeah.
I was wondering who he is.
Yeah, you couldn't tell there, could you?
He doesn't need any introduction at all, as you said. Yeah. What was the intel? What's he got for you this week?
What he had for me this week was a new version of his book, The Double Helix, which is the annotated and illustrated version of it, to mark the 50th anniversary of the Nobel Prize that he and his co-discoverers, Maurice Wilkins and Francis Crick, got for discovering the structure of DNA at Cambridge, at the Cavendish
Lab.
And
this book, Double Helix, is the sort of definitive rip-roaring read about what happened in those heady years.
It reads like a novel, really, more than it reads like than a science book. And it is regularly placed within the top five best science books ever. And so to go back and had a look at it, he's got a couple of, it's edited by a couple of his colleagues, Alexander Gahn and Jan Witkowski. And basically they found a whole pile of Francis Crick's correspondence, for instance, that had gone missing. Sidney Brenner had helped them, another one of the workers up there. And so it puts a whole new perspective on looking at this book and shows, amongst many things, how nearly it didn't happen, because it was a fiercely controversial book at the time, and many people, when he wrote the script, were horrified by what he'd done.
Okay, well, let's listen to a couple of clips. So first of all, the elephant in the room always when we talk about the structure of DNA is the wonderful Rosalind Franklin.
Yes.
She was the person working with Maurice Wilkins at King's College London who made the X-ray crystallography slides that then Francis Crick and James Watson used to, you know, create their structure. So how is he feeling about her these days?
Well, he feels fine about it. What he feels bad about is actually Maurice Wilkins. If you look at the four people that were the team in London, that was Rosalind Franklin and Maurice Wilkins, and then you look at the Cambridge guys, which are Crick and Watson, the only one that was actually had been working on DNA was Wilkins. And then the head of his lab brought in Rosalind Franklin, told her she would be in charge of the DNA work, but didn't tell Maurice Wilkins, who thought he was still going to be in charge. So he produced, this guy Randall, produced an incredible friction and animosity between them, which paralysed their work. And Wilkins was quite convinced that DNA was had a helical structure, but because of the opposition from Franklin, she wouldn't have it. She insisted that they had to experiment, get the experiments absolutely right. And then these two guys come from Cambridge and, you know, flash guys, they describe themselves as that. We're not going to wait. And they were taking evidence for all round the place. And so the Crick and Watson get in there first. It's Wilkins that Watson feels sorry for. And in terms of how he got on with Franklin, he only met her a couple of times, he said, and afterwards they got on perfectly well. And in the case of Crick, when she was dying, she went to stay with Crick and also, you know, was friendly with Watson. So, I mean, the mythology around Franklin is a bit worrying sometimes.
And the other real value of it is it clarifies for the public much more clearly what Rosalind Franklin was like.
Yes.
And letters from her. And
and also letters that reflect on her situation.
Yes.
And this is Randall dropping her.
So, you know, we never felt we were doing anything bad to Rosalind or evil. And I think if you read it, it comes out that, you know, Rosalind just made a bad decision. She, you know, didn't want the B form of DNA, the A form of DNA to be a helix.
And what Wilkins suspected that it was.
He suspected it was a helix before I met him in October of 1951, when I came to Cambridge. She'd been thinking in terms of a helix, and a theoretician at King's named Stokes had calculated the theory for it, which was correct, had not published it. And then when Francis published with Cochrane and Band, the theory of the helices in late 52, probably came out early 52, they mentioned Stokes. And we had to mention Stokes in our paper, didn't it? Moores wanted to mention that they had been thinking, but in fact...
But the issue of the this is a perfect case where we add things to the book that aren't there. So the idea that Rosalind Franklin didn't think DNA was a helix was to do with these two different forms, and the B form, which gave the famous photograph that looked just like a helix, was low quality data, and so she worked on the A form, which gave much more detailed data, but the pattern wasn't so obviously a helix. Mm-hmm. So we have a whole page discussing these different things.
I have it in my memory, from reading it in the past, that she was very much for not hypothesizing and holding back, and you guys were, come on, we're there, push it.
We wanted to be ahead of the data, wanted to follow the data.
Yeah.
So there's a clip of Jim Watson talking about Rosalind Franklin. Robin, you mentioned near the start of this that the book was controversial when it came out, the Double Helix. Why was it so controversial? And I believe it was almost banned at some point.
It's not so much banned as that it was Harvard University were originally going to publish it, and were rather alarmed by the reaction of the people who were involved, such as Crick and such as Bragg, who was the head of the laboratory that they worked for. He was the boss man. He was the man with the Nobel Prize. The man, you know, had the enormous clout. And he was appalled. So was Crick. So were several other people when Watson wrote this very racy account. Half of it about popsies and trying to get laid. Half of it very gossipy. Describes various people, including Bragg himself, as a sort of Colonel Blimp. He writes this thing, and several protagonists are absolutely appalled by it. And Crick, he was furious with Watson, and the letters are now reproduced in this annotated version. I'm saying that you know, in no way must you publish this. And Harvard University eventually dropped it. Enough people came back to Watson for him to believe he had written something that was worthwhile. So he thought of the wheeze of going to Bragg and saying, will you write the introduction for this? Because if Bragg wrote the introduction, there was this Nobel Prize winner, the head of the department, giving it the kind of imprimatur of a legitimate book. And so he wrote it, Bragg wasn't going to do it till he showed it to his wife. And his wife, Alice, said, oh, it's a jolly good book. I think you should back it. So it went round down to the line there. And so Bragg went, oh, all right, then. On you go. And he wrote a little introduction, which, if you look at it, is quite anodyne. And then the book went off. And the interesting thing is that one of the things I asked Watson was, well, how many books has it sold? And he was kind of, I don't know, really. Well, I think it sold 88,000 in hardback in America. And I said, well, how about paperbacks? I kind of poked him. Over a million, at least, you know. I mean, what kind of author doesn't know how many copies of your book you don't know?
He's checking Amazon every day.
Yeah, I bet, you know.
Robin, what's it like to meet Jim Watson?
It's not what you expect, you know. He doesn't stick to a subject. He'll wander off, and he's... I think we've had to edit the tape very heavily from the libelous remarks he made about everybody that he knows. So he doesn't. He just shoots from the hip, and of course it gets him into terrible trouble. But it's great fun to be with.
It certainly has got him into terrible trouble. Certainly, a few years ago, when he was in the UK, he had to fly back, cancel lots of engagements because of I don't want to say a missaying. He probably meant exactly what he said.
My question was really just, what would have happened if Rosalind Franklin hadn't have died before the Nobel Prize?
Right, so what we have is we have these two pairs working for it. Only three people can win a Nobel Prize. Franklin got cancer and died before the Nobel Prize would come out. And it's always been an issue, particularly among feminists, that that she was somehow done down, and would have been done down. It's interesting what Watson said. He said if she was still alive when the Nobel Prize was given out, they probably would have delayed giving it to them and would in the end only have given it to Crick and Watson. Several years later, and that Wilkins would have basically got nothing.
What was his explanation for that?
I didn't ask him that. It was a complete hypothesis on his behalf. I was slightly taken aback. I assumed that he would say that she would have got it and Wilkins wouldn't have. But Watson paints Wilkins more as a tragic figure nowadays than perhaps less so than Franklin as a tragic figure.
We were talking about the annotated version of The Double Helix by James Watson, which is available in all good bookshops now. There'll be a link to that on the blog. Meanwhile, thanks very much to Robin McKee and also to Ian Sample. You'll be able to read Robin's article about the new edition of Jim Watson's book at guardian.co.uk/science and also the fine paper product we call The Observer. But that's it for this week for Science Weekly. From me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Don't forget to sign up for free to The Guardian's Global Development Professionals Network, and you could be in with the chance of winning an iPad. Find out more now at guardian.co.uk/win the iPad.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.